The CDC reports that bird flu is widespread in wild birds worldwide and is leading in outbreaks in poultry and U.S. dairy cows. There have been several recent human cases involving dairy and poultry workers. What do you need to know now?
Will this cause the next pandemic? We don't know. But I can tell you with certainty there will be another influenza pandemic, and we're very ill prepared for one if it were to happen now. And so we do need to keep a very close watch on what's happening with the current H5N1.
Our guests are going to fill us in on the latest. Dr. Michael Osterholm has nearly 50 years of investigating infectious disease outbreaks and public health threats. Apoorva Mundivili reports on science and global health for the New York Times with a focus on infectious diseases, pandemics, and the public health agencies that try to manage them.
I think one thing that's been really frustrating for me as a reporter is the lack of communication from federal and state agencies to reporters and also among themselves. Because one thing I reported was there were a lot of scientists wondering, you know, are cows getting reinfected with this virus?
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, welcome back, Dr. Osterholm and Apoorva Mundivili to Conversations on Healthcare. Good to see you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Yeah. And let's start with Apoorva. You recently reported in the Times that cows have been infected with a second form of the bird flu called H5N1. And this version of the virus seems to be widespread now in wild birds, but had not previously been detected in cows. I'm wondering if you could share more with our listeners.
So just to be clear, both versions are H5N1. They're just different subtypes of H5N1. And we've been seeing one of them for over a year now in dairy cattle. And then the second one has come up much more recently, is all of a sudden in wild birds everywhere. And then we've just seen it in cattle again. So now it means we have two versions of H5N1 circulating in the country that are both capable of jumping from birds to cattle, which they've already done, and from cattle to people, which also seems like it has happened.
Well, Apoorva, you've reported on the CDC posting and then deleting data on the bird flu spreading between cats and people. And there are other reports that the government is holding back a study about veterinarians who treat cattle and if they've been unknowingly infected by the bird flu virus. What can you tell us about the situation? It seems so important to get this information out there.
Yeah, I think that the key there is actually the fact that we haven't had the information. The fact that cats may be transmitted to a person and that maybe a person transmitted to a cat, that in itself is not super surprising because we expect if they're in close proximity, maybe there is a way that that could have happened. But the fact that we don't even really fully know because we haven't seen the full paper, what I wrote is based on one data table that happened to be by accident, maybe on purpose, who knows, in a paper about wildfires in LA and the air quality. That table just happened to be there for a very brief period of time, and I happened to get a hold of that. So all of that information is based on that one table. But really, as Dr. Osterholm will say, I'm sure, we need to see all of the data to see what exactly has been going on there. And do we need to be more worried? Do we not? It's impossible to say without seeing the rest of the bird flu papers that we've heard are at the CDC, but have not yet seen the light of day.
Well, Michael, you say that we need to see the data because in part you're the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. You stated that we should be surprised, or we should not be surprised, that a new spillover to cattle, given the very significant activity in waterfowl across much of the United States. And you have somewhat of a graphic way of explaining that. Remember, we're a family show here. I wonder if you could share that with our audience.
Well, first of all, this is an unprecedented event in all the influenza world. You know, I've been very involved with influenza for more than 40 years, had worked with H5N1 in Southeast Asia way back in 2003, 4, and 5, and have worked with it ever since. And what's happened is in the last 3 years, we've had a brand new strain of the H5N1 emerge. And within that strain, what we've seen then are these two different genotypes, the D1.1, which is the one that's primarily in wild migratory birds spilling over. And then what spilled over into the dairy cattle, which was B31.13. And so they're both H5N1s. What's really challenging right now is for us to understand what's happening in cattle, because we've seen very little information from the USDA over the course of the last month as to understand what's happening there. There appears to be only limited, if any, new human infections in that area, but we're now hearing about additional new infections in Nevada and California in cattle. In terms of the other side of the ledger here with the D1.1, I think this is the more remarkable story. Right now, North America is swimming in H5N1 from wild migratory waterfowl. It turns out that there are about 40 million of these birds in the continental United States and Canada. And normally you would think of migratory birds leaving from northern Canada, northern states like Minnesota, and heading to the south, to the Gulf and so forth. But that's changed over recent years as more and more warm bodies of water have been made by man, either electrical generating plants or heating plants. In addition, large sewer lagoons that are operating from cities, as well as even large dairy cattle operations where the water never freezes. We have right now in Minnesota a plenty of wild waterfowl here in the first week of February, despite temperatures well below zero. As long as there's open water, they'll be there. So that's why you're seeing also all these outbreaks in poultry production facilities throughout much of the United States, because the waterfowl are largely infected. This should not surprise us, and we'd see more spillovers into, for example, cattle, or that we would see them in humans. I think we're going to see more sporadic cases showing up in humans that are really tied to inhaling what is basically bird poop. These waterfowl are well known for leaving behind that wherever they're at. And I think that that's a huge challenge right now for us.
Michael, I wonder if I could get you maybe we'll go up 1,000 feet and look at what people need to know. We've talked about CDC. There being maybe papers at CDC that we'd like to get. We've talked about not having access to all the information. What's the role of the state health departments in this, in terms of reporting what's happening in Minnesota or what's happening in Connecticut, and reporting on the human cases as well? Are the states doing that reporting independently, or do we all have to depend on CDC for this information?
Well, the states are reporting that. And again, it's really important to remember that as far as public health goes, it's a states' rights issue, meaning public health is not described in the Constitution, which automatically means it defers to the state for primary authority. The problem with it is that states have invested very little in public health. In our own state here, 95% of all the support we have at our state health department comes from federal sources. So in many instances, we're really caught in terms of the state conducting their business and what they can report and not report. In addition, we've seen a growing number of states, particularly red states, where they just aren't making information available. And so it's a real challenge for us in public health to know exactly what's going on. And in a situation where, you know, will this cause the next pandemic? We don't know. But I can tell you with certainty there will be another influenza pandemic, and we're very ill prepared for one if it were to happen now. And so we do need to keep a very close watch on what's happening with the current H5N1, but knowing that tomorrow we could be surprised by another flu virus that emerges and causes the next pandemic.
You know, just to give our audience a sense of the scope of the problem, H5N1 has affected over 156 million commercial backyard and wild birds in our country during the past 3 years. Michael, you've discussed the poultry industry's need to do more to stop infections. Maybe be a little more specific of what type of actions they should take.
Well, you know, I was actually involved back in 2015 with the first culling or depopulation activities around that entering into poultry in Minnesota, when in that year over 20 million birds here in the upper Midwest died as a result of the virus getting into poultry production facilities and egg laying facilities. And at the time, a lot of the effort was really aimed at biosecurity. It was defined by making sure people didn't go from one farm to the other, that they had clean clothes, boots washed, trucks, etc., all that kind of thing. But it was clearly not enough. And there was data from a study done in the by Iowa State University showing that it was likely predicted what barns would break next downwind from previous barns that broke in the days or two before. And it was classic airborne transmission of this virus. And I think that there is much more of it than we realize. And once it gets inside one of these barns, and they're not airtight, then these birds are highly susceptible to that virus. And of course, the only thing you can do is cull the entire flock of birds because they're all going to die anyway. And so my recommendation back in 2015 hasn't changed 10 years later. They need to make these barns airtight with HEPA filter air intakes so that they can screen out this virus. So if it's blowing across fields, and again, if you've ever been to a location where a flock of Canadian geese have just been, there is, you know, all over the environment, you're going to see bird poop, and it's going to basically over time dry and be able to be put into the air and breathed in. So I think you're not going to see a real change in a meaningful way in terms of the risk for poultry operations till they understand this airborne risk.
And does that jump to humans at that point? What's the pathway? Jumps to animals?
Yeah. I think at this point, Mark, what's going to happen is that we are going to see more isolated human cases. I'm confident we haven't missed a lot right now. Right on an average week, there's about 3,500 specimens in the United States of flu A cases, meaning either influenza A, H1N1 or H3N2, or now also looking for H5N1. And over the past several weeks, even with all those tests, they've all been H1N1 or H3N2. There's been no evidence of H5N1. So I don't think we're seeing a lot, but it wouldn't surprise me if we start seeing more isolated cases. And if you're thinking of a model for this, think of basically Coccidioides mycoses, this fungal disease, the San Joaquin Valley, you know, valley fever, where it blows in the air and people inhale it. I think you're going to start seeing more of that with this because there is just so much virus out there and in these 40 million wild migratory birds. And then on top of that, remember, they're continuing to have new chicks every year. And so at this point, they are going to have fresh new birds for infection that are going to keep happening.
Wow. Well, the critical question on people's minds, of course, is how it affects humans. But I understand it's mild to severe respiratory symptoms are possible in pink eye. Apoorva, how do you communicate with patients about this? What parts of the country should a patient with respiratory symptoms and pink eye be thinking that this could be the cause, or their care teams thinking this could be the cause? I can tell you where we live, I don't think it's on the radar, and we're one big open country. Kind of imagine it's got to be all over the country at this point. Tell us about that.
It is all over the country at this point. There's the wild birds are everywhere, and so is the virus. Right. So I don't think there's any particular part of the country where we can feel like, oh, if you have flu A, it's probably not H5N1. I mean, just a couple of days ago, they shut down the wild bird markets in the poultry markets in New York City because they found H5N1 here. So that's happened in the cities. Many, many months ago, I wrote about birds that were found in Central Park in New York City that had H5N1. They're in Idaho. They're in California, they're, you know, down south. There's not really a part of the country that is safe. So far, I think what has been somewhat reassuring is that most cases have seemed relatively mild. I don't want to say mild as if nothing happened, because even when we've talked about conjunctivitis, it's a pretty severe conjunctivitis. It looks like they've got blood in their eyes, but it's not fatal. And the only person we've seen die of it so far has been one person in Louisiana who had the D11 version that we were just talking about, the newer one that's been in the Nevada herds. There's no reason to think that that's why that's more severe. It's because of that particular subtype, but it does seem as if most people have been able to get away with just respiratory symptoms and some conjunctivitis, and we haven't seen the kind of fatality we worried about with this virus, because in Southeast Asia, when we've seen cases, we've seen mortality rates of something like 40 to 50%. And we are not prepared for anything close to that. But so far, at least, we're not seeing any signs of that. I do want to get back to one thing that Dr. Osterholm mentioned about the states. I think one thing that's been really frustrating for me as a reporter is the lack of communication from federal and state agencies to reporters, and also among themselves. Because one thing I reported was there were a lot of scientists wondering, you know, are cows getting reinfected with this virus? And that's information that's really valuable, because we need to know, will they keep getting infected, or will this burn itself out at some point? And apparently there was a reinfected herd in Idaho, maybe more than one, but that's not information that came from the federal government. And in fact, when I went to ask them that, they said, oh, no, we don't know of any new herds infected in Idaho since October. Meanwhile, Idaho is saying they did find them in November, and that those were reinfections. So that lack of clarity, the confusion, the lack of communication between federal and state, all of that has been extremely frustrating to follow along what's going on.
Maybe to both of you, and while this is an issue across the country, it's really not a kitchen table issue at this point, except I noted in the above the fold in our statewide paper today, the headlines was egg cost bringing turbulent times. It was really talking about the $7.50 on average cost for a dozen eggs, maybe hitting to 15 bucks in June. Walk me through what the crosswalk might be from that reality to getting people more educated about what's happening. What's your sense of what it should be a kitchen table conversation, but often isn't around healthcare, but certainly the economy of this is taking a big toll, right?
Right. You know, and if I could just comment on the human side, then I'll comment on the egg side. You know, people are very confused. You have CDC saying that this is a very low risk situation for humans, and you had a state like California declaring a public health emergency over this issue. And guess what? They're both right. The California situation was all about trying to move resources into the agricultural community that required an emergency declaration to try to deal with the herd infected in California. At the same time, CDC is right. This still is a very low-risk situation for any serious illness in humans. The problem with this is think of this model where you're walking across this very, very flat piece of land for days and days and days. Seems like it's pretty predictable what's going to happen until you take one long step and you fall down a 150-foot ravine. Okay, all of a sudden you're over the edge. If we're going to see a pandemic of influenza in humans, it's likely to occur quickly. Whatever changes that the virus requires to make it that pandemic strain are going to happen overnight. And I think we're going to find ourselves in that situation. Our problem is we don't know when that's going to happen. As I say often, you know, the pandemic clock is ticking. We just don't know what time it is. And H5N1 may never do it. H5N1 may have already done it today, and we didn't know it yet. Hmm. And so I think that's the challenge that people have is, when is this really an important issue for me or not? But the issue that they do know and recognize is that around what are egg prices? And that's even if they can find eggs, let alone whatever they cost. And that's going to continue to be a problem. You know, we have such widespread infection right now throughout the country in these migratory waterfowl that they're continuing to spread this into these barns, as we've just talked about. And I just don't see any break coming in the future till the agricultural community changes what they're doing. Maybe the buildings, there surely is some potential role for vaccines in these chickens. But on a whole, it's not one that I think is going to get solved soon.
You know, you mentioned earlier, too, that there were 156 million birds infected. And I want to point out that's not the number of birds infected. That's the number of birds killed because there were some were infected. And so that, I think, is the real issue here is even when you have some birds that are infected, you have to end up culling the entire flock. And so you end up wiping out massive numbers of birds in one fell swoop. You know, we just had a farm in Long Island that had to kill 100,000 birds in one weekend. So it really makes a huge impact. And that is going to really play into the availability of eggs. I think you saw Denny was charging extra for eggs.
Right.
I mean, this is the thing that people will start to notice. But it's also not a bad thing for them to notice as long as there's not panic, because they do need to take certain precautions, right? We don't want people necessarily eating raw eggs at this particular moment in time. It's probably okay, but may not be. And it's also, you know, you don't want people eating raw meat and drinking raw milk and doing things that are unnecessary risks at a time when we are seeing so much of the virus out in the environment.
Well, of course, you've just mentioned a few things that have come back into sort of public consciousness with some of the trends we're hearing in the media about everything from raw milk to raw eggs in pursuit of health. But I think I want to back up again, maybe in remembering, Michael, that we had the opportunity to talk many times during COVID. I remember one conversation, you know, what would we want to learn from this that will help us the next time, right? How do we learn from our experiences with public health issues to be better prepared? And what should we be doing today? What could we have done if we'd only known back in the COVID days that we might be thinking about now in terms of communication, protection across the board, local preparedness, and how is that playing out, do you think?
First of all, I think it's really an important point to note that we're probably less prepared to respond to a pandemic today than we were in 2020 with COVID. And that is in part due to the fact that we just really have a lack of trust in our public health system today. And much of what is going to have to happen during a pandemic again is going to be a series of recommendations about how do we get through this. And so as one who has really pushed forward for having a major review of COVID and how we responded, not to blame or point fingers, but to have lessons learned, we haven't done that. The second thing is, I don't think people realize how fragile the immunization potential is against COVID. And I say that because today we have the ability to make about 3.8 billion doses of influenza vaccine every year. And that's a year. That means that if, when the new virus emerges, we'd have to put that into production. 3.8 million sounds like a lot to you realize it's a two-dose vaccine. And so we could only vaccinate right now about a fourth of the world in the first year. And we'd be hard pressed to even have enough vaccine by the third year for the world itself. So we're in trouble that way. And we just haven't recognized the need to invest in that kind of infrastructure. We're doing more work with mRNA vaccines, and hopefully that can surely help us. But I think right now we would have many challenges trying to get safe, effective vaccines to the public if a pandemic were to emerge tomorrow.
You know, I want to get into the mRNA in a minute, but Apoorva, you've been talking about trust in the healthcare system, in the public health system, how it's diminished in terms of people's faith in the FDA or the CDC. But you do note that there still continues to be faith in your primary care provider, right? But walk us through sort of the challenges any pandemic or any large medical issue is going to have when we've seen this diminution in support for the public health system.
I mean, I think it's not a surprise, right, that we've seen all of this the very heavy political influence on how public health is viewed. And so there are so many people in this country now who don't trust the CDC for advice on how to protect themselves. There are so many people who don't trust in the FDA to make decisions free of commercial interests. We have people who are incoming in the administration, like RFK Jr., who looks like he's probably going to be the head of HHS, who has said very critical things about childhood immunizations. He has even called the bird flu vaccines, the H5N1 vaccines that we have in the stockpile, he's called them dangerous. And even though he did reassure people during his confirmation that he would back a bird flu vaccine, there are all these questions about what would actually happen if we were to have a pandemic. I think a big part of the issue during COVID was that people did not trust that they were being given all of the information. Some of that was unavoidable because information was changing, but it created this perception that the CDC was lying to them and telling them one thing one day and saying something else another day. That is true. They literally were doing that. But part of that is because the information changed. However, I do want to point out there were times when they didn't say everything they could have, or they said it in with maybe more confidence than was warranted by the information available to them. And I think there was some amount of wanting to keep everybody calm by only giving them certain amounts of information. And that seems to also be an overarching theme now. You know, it's only, I would say, I've been talking to the CDC very regularly for the past year plus about this particular bird flu outbreak. And it's only in the last conversation I had with them where they said, yeah, it is low risk right now, but that could change, as Dr. Ostrom just said earlier. It took them that long to say that. Before that, it always just was, it's low risk. And that is true at that point in time, but without that, but that could change, it doesn't really give people the sense that they are in good hands, that they will be treated with honesty and candor when the time comes, that they will get all the information they need to protect themselves. But I do think it's interesting that while the public health agencies are not trusted, people do really trust their physicians. Yeah. So if that messaging can at least go to their own doctors, that's still a way that you can reach people.
Might simple apologies have worked for both the CDC and some of the other agencies? It didn't seem like they ever had an honest conversation with the American public.
I think that would have gone a long way to say we did not give you all the information you needed as soon as we had it, and next time we will do better.
Well, into the breach, others will step with information or communication to keep these issues before us. And I know the Kaiser Family Foundation conducted a poll in January and found that Most people said they're not concerned that they or a family member would get sick from bird flu, but almost half, or 44%, said they are somewhat or very concerned about a widespread outbreak in the United States. That in and of itself kind of surprised me, that it was at that level of consciousness in a general poll. Do you think this is a good sign that people are paying attention but not panicking? You know, COVID, we had no such ramp, right? It was nothing, and then it was here in front of us, and we all remember those early days. Do you think we'll do better with people just keeping calm, but educating themselves and learning what's going on?
Well, you know, I actually think that this is a challenge relative to the fatigue issue. You know, I'm beginning to hear from people who are saying, oh, you guys are just all crying fire in a crowded theater. You know, we've heard this over and over again from you. And again, you know, my message has been continuously, this is all about the next influenza pandemic, which will happen. We just don't know when it's going to occur and which virus is going to cause it. You know, I, as I noted earlier, been very involved with H5N1 dating back to Thailand, Vietnam, and Indonesia back in 2003 and 2004. In 2012, I was on the National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity, where two researchers brought data to us saying we're only one mutation away from this virus causing the next pandemic. Then we saw in the Nile River Valley in 2015-16, 150 plus cases in duck farmers, half of them died. Oh, now it's going to do it. And actually, it was really from that time until really the 2 years ago that there was the quietest period for H5N1 in the entire history since 1996 and 97. And so I think even those of us who work on this issue very closely don't really know what it means. Will it, in fact, basically become the next pandemic? So that's hard to convey to the public. So my message to the public is we got to be ready. It is going to happen. We will have a pandemic. I just don't know which one is going to be.
I wonder. I want to be a slightly more optimistic there and think that maybe because people are familiar with the flu, because they're familiar with the 1918 pandemic, because they know that there is an idea of another flu pandemic. And I think because it affects kids, it generally has affected kids. I think when they see that, there will be a bit more of taking seriously than there was with COVID, where it was sort of easy to dismiss as, oh, you know, it only affects people of a certain age group or with certain conditions and everybody else is fine. I think when people see that it actually, that's not the case, that young people can be affected, kids can be affected, that maybe that will turn the tide, but I might be overly optimistic there.
Is there any best practice that you're seeing around the globe, anything at the EU or World Health Organization in terms of how they're addressing this issue that we might learn from? Not that we're going to learn from other parts of the world. Sometimes we tend to be stubborn here, but where might we look?
I think right now the Europeans are way ahead of us in terms of vaccinating poultry and successfully holding back infections from really evolving inside the poultry industry. Now, that doesn't take it outside of the wildlife, though, of course. We're still seeing a substantial amount of virus there. But I think we have lessons to learn from them about potentially using poultry vaccines.
President Trump has appointed Gerald Parker to be the new head of the White House Office of Pandemic Preparedness and Response Policy. Can we take this as a good sign? Because previously the president said he wanted to shut the office down.
Yeah, I think it's a good sign. Someone who's worked with Jerry for the last 20 years, I think he can bring some important leadership there. And I think the fact that the office still exists is obviously very important.
We're not talking to the WHO right now, and we're also not talking to the CDC. Oh, the CDC is not allowed to talk to anybody. Yeah. So those are some big obstacles that we would need to get past if we had something serious to do with.
I would agree. And I think the other issue is that realizing the time-sensitive nature of this interview, we're all on bated breath right now. There's going to be a major reduction in force at CDC. There surely appears to be every indication that's going to occur. And should that occur, like Apova just said about WHO, these are going to be major challenges in terms of maintaining public health activities, major challenges.
Right. Well, we appreciate that we are still talking with you and want to thank you, Michael and Apova, for joining us. Thank you to our audience for being here. Just a reminder, be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube, find us on Facebook and X, and please do share your thoughts and your comments about this program. Take care and be well. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.